Let's turn our attention now to Acts chapter 28. We're considering the Apostle Paul and his travels to Rome as a prisoner. And the incident of the shipwreck, we concluded with chapter 27, noting that they came to the land on planks, some swam, but all escaped safely, the last statement of verse 44 of chapter 27. Now, as we introduce our study for the 28th chapter, I want to note, beginning in verse 1, it says, "And when they were escaped, then we knew that the island was called Melita. And the barbarians showed us no common kindness, for they kindled a fire and received us all, because of the present rain and because of the cold. And when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out by reason of the heat and fastened on his hand." We'll talk about that. What I want to notice just here is where they are. And you'll see on this map down at the bottom of this page where they are located in relationship to where they are attempting to go on their journey to Rome. And you see labeled on this chart that they've been lost in the sea, or in the storm in the sea. And this small island, Melita, is identified for us here. Now, I want to note in verse 2, it tells us that the barbarians showed us no common kindness. Well, if it was no common kindness, then the point is they showed common kindness. And we want to note that little word, barbarian. When you think of a barbarian, what typically comes to your mind?
Uncivilized,
yeah. Well, the idea here is simply they were natives. And they were unlike, obviously, those that were on the ship. They were people that lived on this island, likely didn't do a lot of travel going from place to place. And so consequently, these are the people that are on the island, and they show them some kindness. They kindled the fire and received us because of the present rain, because of the cold. Well, we've noted that these are barbarians. We noted that they prepared a fire because of the present rain and because of the cold. We're acquainted somewhat, I suppose, with that. And one of the things that we want to note is that they have been shipwrecked, how they get to the shore. They've been in the ocean, they're wet, they're cold, it's raining, it's cold. Did I remind you that it's cold? And so they built a fire. Now, one of the things that we want to note later on in this chapter is that there are how many people on board this ship? 276. We've actually noted that in verse 37 of the previous chapter. 276 people on board this ship. Some of them, of course, are soldiers. Some of them are prisoners. Some of them are just other folks seeking transportation. Some of them are people that labored on the ship. One of the things that we want to note is that in order to accommodate that many people, we're going to see further evidence of this as we discuss the next few verses, but to accommodate that many people, they had to build a big fire. Nearly 300 people to be warmed and dried out and made comfortable by this fire necessitated a lot of wood. And one of the things you see in verse 3, that when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out by reason of the heat and fastened on his hand. And when the barbarians saw the venomous creature hanging from his hand, they said one to another, and we'll talk about the rest of that verse in just a moment. Let's talk about this snake. Paul was gathering wood to put on the fire, which tells us very simply that he, once again, is being shown kindness by those soldiers who are in charge of his well-being and in charge of his security. He's working. He's gathering wood to lay on the fire. As you well know, even in this area, that in cold weather, snakes are pretty much dormant. If you come upon a snake, they move rather slowly. But as they heat up, what happens? They become active, yes. And Paul gathered up this bundle of sticks to put on the fire, and when the wood became a little bit warm, the snake came out and attached itself to Paul's hand. Now, some of the things that we want to note just here is nothing more than speculation. If you've read commentaries on this particular passage, You read whether or not the snake was indeed poisonous. You read whether or not the snake, by its very nature, was one that would bite and hang on, or it would like strike and be done. That's just a bunch of foolishness. What we want to note is what the text says. The text tells us that the snake was poisonous. The text tells us that the snake hung on to his hand. The text tells us that he shook it off into the fire. Now, that's what we know about this snake. Now, observing that, these people that saw these things, the barbarians, as we call them, that lived on this island, they come to the conclusion in verse 4, no doubt this man is a murderer, though he had escaped from the sea, yet justice hath not suffered to live. Now, justice is somebody's name. It's the Greek goddess of justice. And their contention, as you see, is typical Greek mythology. They think that here is a man who has escaped the peril of the sea. Here is a man who is a prisoner, and he's obviously worthy of death. And so this poisonous snake has bitten him, and justice has its way. So Paul's going to die. That tells you that these barbarians believe the snake was poisonous. And so, end of that story. But it tells us that he shook off the creature into the fire and took no harm. But they expected that he would have swollen or fallen down dead suddenly. But when they were long in expectation and beheld nothing amiss come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. Question, does that sound like some familiar history that we're well aware of? Like in about chapter 14, where initially they thought that Paul and Barnabas were, or Paul and Silas were gods, and then consequently they swung the pendulum the other way and thought, well, no, they're not gods, they're men that need to be put to death, and so they tried to stone Paul to death there in Lystra and took him outside the city and did so, and they thought they had accomplished their task, they left him for dead. So all of this together helps us to understand the kind of thinking that the idolatrous world had, and those in particular that were associated with Greek mythology. And that's where they are. And so now they think that Paul is some kind of a god. Now, more on that just a little bit later. Question, has taken place, Paul being bitten by this snake, and their perception that this obviously was a poisonous snake, and they expected him, like someone else who had been bitten by a poisonous snake, to swell up, and at the very least, but even perhaps to die. And now nothing happens. It says that he came to no harm. Would you conclude that a miracle had taken place? Yes, this was miraculous. And does it sound familiar of what the Lord had said when he gave the commission to the apostles that they were to go and preach the gospel to every creature? And if you'll turn back to Mark chapter 16, you'll note in verse 16, he said, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that disbelieveth shall be condemned. And these signs shall accompany them that believe in my name. They shall cast out demons, and they shall speak with new tongues. They shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall in no wise hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." Now, I want you to remember the incidences that are mentioned in this passage as Jesus is giving the marching orders to the apostles. Here Paul has taken up a bundle of sticks that has a deadly serpent in it, and it bites him, and there is no harm. Jesus said that would happen. Now, question. When we think about the things that are in the realm of the miraculous, now it's not our purpose today to try to establish that miracles are not present-day occurrences. We could talk about that at some length if you would so desire. If you have any question about that, I'd be delighted and am prepared to pursue that as a discussion. But what I want to know just here is, what was the purpose of the miracles? to confirm the Word. Now, those of you that are in many of our classes know that I'm going to ask you, where do we find that? We need a passage to associate with that. That that was the purpose of the miracles. If you're going to establish that point, you need to be able to point at the verse that says that's the case. Where is it?
Hebrews 2:4.
Very good. Very good. That was the purpose of the miracles, to confirm that the word spoken was indeed the truth. Now let's just go ahead and pursue this point briefly. Why do we not have miracles performed today? You know, back where I came from, now you don't see that a whole lot out here, but back in the country that I came from, and especially you get a little further east from the country that I was reared here, in over into the Appalachian Mountains, you'll find people that believe in handling snakes, and they do this in religious services. They have a basket full of rattlesnakes or copperheads or water moccasins, and they start passing them out. And I don't have any selfish bone in my body. I don't want one. And if there's not enough to go around, that's fine. I'll be the one that don't get one. Now, when we look at people that do that, why do they do that?
I think they're trying to imitate what they've read, but they haven't read it with an understanding.
Well, that's right. And bottom line down here, that's ignorance. Now, I use that word because it's an accurate word. Not necessarily intended to be derogatory. Ignorance simply means somebody that don't know. And sometimes when you're reared in that kind of environment, everybody believes that, and so consequently you grow up believing that, and you haven't learned any different. And what happens to some of the people that want to handle the snakes like they believe Paul did? They die. Now some say, well, I can build up a tolerance to the poison of them. That's not a miracle. You can build up a tolerance to certain kinds of drugs and poisons so that they don't bother you like they ordinarily would. But what we want to note, this was in the realm of the miraculous. These people fully expected Paul to either get sick or to die. And the text clearly tells us that there was no harm. Now, what does that tell us about the things that Paul was preaching or did preach to these people?
It was right.
Now, some of those on board the ship have already learned that the things that Paul tells them, that it's right. Now these on this island are learning that what Paul has to say is right. Because here is a miracle, one of many, as you look down into the text, that follow. And we know that the purpose of all of them was to confirm that the word spoken was from God. Now, they couldn't just pick up their New Testament and turn to it and read it like you can. But we know that the completed revelation has been given, and therefore it has been confirmed. It does not continue to need to be confirmed because it has been already. Now, what we look at here is this miracle occurs, and Paul did not die. And you'll notice in the next few verses, it tells us in verse 7, now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island named Publius, who received us and entertained us 3 days courteously. And it was so that the father of Publius lay sick of fever and dysentery, unto whom Paul entered in and prayed, and laying his hands on him, healed him. Now, two or three things that we want to note. I understand that on this particular island there was, we might refer to it as a parasite that would get into the body of people and cause dysentery. And it could be deadly. And we know in this instance that this man was very sick. Let's notice, first of all, who he is. Publius. He is a chief man of the island. Now, we're going to see that he had a considerable amount of land. The text tells us that he received us and entertained us 3 days courteously. Now, one of the things that some have supposed, and I think that probably there's some merit to the argument, that not only is this an important man, but he might very well be some kind of Roman official on the island. But the point is, he's sick and he's got a lot of land, and he's making some effort to be hospitable to 276 people. His dad is sick. Okay, I didn't read that correctly. Didn't say it correctly. His father was sick. Verse 8. Point being, here is a man who's expressing hospitality to 276 people that have nothing. Now, I think it's important that we underscore that. These people that are on this island, that have been saved from the shipwreck, have nothing. What happened to their food? Threw it overboard. What happened to the tackling of the ship? Threw it overboard. What happened to the ship? It's destroyed. Some of them float to the island on planks. Others swim. They're there with nothing. Now, how would you like to take the responsibility of 276 people who have nothing? You see, that is a problem. It tells us some things about this man. It tells us, number one, that he has some resource. Number two, it tells us that he has some compassion for these people. And it tells us, number three, that this is not an altogether unexpected or uncommon occurrence. Now, one of the things that we want to note about this man is that his father, verse 8, lay sick with this fever, dysentery, and Paul entered in and prayed for him and laid his hands on him and he got well. Now, does this mean that whatever problem that he had just eventually over a period of weeks and months went away? No, this was in the realm of the miraculous as well. Now, somebody might reason and say, well, wasn't Luke the doctor traveling with him? Maybe Luke came. Nothing said about Luke giving medicine to this man. Paul went in and laid his hands on him, and he got well immediately. We need to underscore that. And you say, well, Mick, the word immediately. So I know it's not there, but that's not the point. This was in the realm of miraculous. Miracles occur immediately. This man got well, and it was such an event, it says, and when this was done, the rest also that had diseases in the island came and were cured. That indicates that what Paul did was beyond giving this man some medicine that began to take care of the parasites. What this tells us was that whatever was afflicting anybody else on the island, Paul could heal them. Again, in the realm of the miraculous. Now, what was the response? In verse 10, who also honored us with many honors, and when we sailed, they put on board such things as we needed. Notice again, 276 people. Chapter 27, verse 36. Now, one of the things that I want to note here is, who's writing this account? And what was his occupation?
Physician.
He was a physician. Notice the words. This man lay sick, a fever, and dysentery. Luke, a doctor, tells us precisely what was wrong with this man. One of the things that we want to note is Luke, who was a physician, tells us that Paul did the healing. So the doctor didn't attend to this. Paul did. Miraculous. And others on the island who were sick also were cured. Now, in verse 10, I want to note this point before we go on to verse 11. We might think it's not all that big of a point, but it's one I think we need to note. Who also honored us with many honors. And when we sailed, they put on board such things as we needed. When they began to prepare to leave this island, next verse tells us they were there for 3 months. That's a lengthy period of time to assume the responsibility of 276 people. But not just to assume the current needs of 276 people, but if you'll notice on the map, they've got a journey yet to get to Rome. Chris?
And not only again to commend Publius for what he did, but again, the same God who was with Paul and all the passengers on that ship before shipwreck is still with them.
That is right.
Again, the promise to Paul was, you're going to go to Rome. He wasn't going to die in the sea. He wasn't going to die on this island. Again, we see God's continued provisions for him and for everything else.
That's right. God has told him that twice in this account of Acts, that he's going to make it all the way to Rome, that he would preach in Rome. You see that in Acts 23:11, Acts 27:24. He's going to Rome. And you'll also note the reference of Paul writing to the Romans in Romans chapter 15, beginning in verses 30 through verse 32. So yes, God is still with them. Now, after being there for 3 months, 276 people, did I mention again how many people there are? That is a lot of people to assume responsibility for, not only for a 3 month period of time, but to send them on their journey. There's quite a little distance they have yet to go in order to get to Rome. And these on this island, and including this particular man, are making provisions for these people. They're taking care of them. Now, we want to learn something from that. One of the things that we want to learn from that is about hospitality. We can learn how to be kind. The text tells us that they were kind. They honored us with these things. We learn what's involved in kindness. Somebody's cold, what do you do for them? Say, go away and be warmed and filled, right? No. The kind of faith that saves, James says, is not that kind of faith, but the kind of faith that does. Now, when you look at people like these people on this island that are doing these things for these people, do you think that they might be folks who would be receptive to the teaching of this man? What was the purpose of the miracles? To confirm that the word spoken was true. Do you think Paul spoke the word? Well, yeah. Wouldn't have been any point for the miracles if he wasn't going to teach them. He taught them. And he stayed there for 3 months. Now, one of the things that we want to note is in the latter part of verse 11, it tells us that they set sail in a ship of Alexandria, which had wintered in the island. This wintering was something that was common occurrence. So their desire had been, as we've studied, to winter in Phoenix off the island of Crete. But now they finish out the winter on this island of Melita. One of the things we want to note is that there are others. This ship of Alexandria. Now, is that the first time we've read about a ship of Alexandria? Where was this ship from? Don't just say Alexandria. And down in where?
Egypt.
Down in Egypt. That's right. So here's a ship that's traveled quite some distance. They found a safe place to harbor there. And so they spent the remainder of the winter there. Now they're on their way. We noted that the captain of the ship, I've forgotten his name, and it wasn't Claudius Lysias. It was Julius who had found the ship going from Myra, the ship of Alexandria that had shipwrecked, and now he's found another ship.
He was a centurion, not a captain.
Okay, what was the captain's name? Is it given? Not given? Okay, the centurion's name was Julius. So they found another ship from Alexandria on their way to Rome. No doubt a cargo ship, much like the one that they were on their way to Rome. Now, having said that, in verse 11, continuing, it said, whose sign was the twin brothers. Now, some of you may be reading from a translation that gives you a little bit more information on that. Anything beyond twin brothers?
Twin brothers figurative.
I didn't hear.
Twin gods as a figure.
Okay. All right. I understand that this indicates Castor and Pollux. Pollux, sons of Jupiter, these were considered the deities of the sailors. And so this sign of this ship was such. And they get on board. It tells us, touching at Syracuse, we tarried there for 3 days. And from thence we made a circuit and arrived at Regine. And after 1 day, a south wind sprang up. And on the second day, we came to Ptolemy. Now, one of the things that some of you are much more familiar with sailing than I am, I've never done any of that. Some of you have perhaps been on larger ships, some of you on smaller ships, some sailing, some motivated pushed along by huge engines, I don't know. But our point is that when you're sailing, you don't have to know a lot about sailing. I've made little boards and put little flags on them and set them on the puddles in the farm, sail them across the pond. And one of the things that you learn, even on such a small scale, is the ship generally goes in the direction that the wind is carrying it. And so when you're sailing, you may have to wait here or there until the direction of the wind begins to change. I never have. Maybe some of you could enlighten me how that you could take a ship and work the sails so that you can sail contrary to the wind. I don't understand how that all works, but one of the things I do know is sometimes the winds prevent you from sailing in the direction that you want to go, and so you have to wait until the winds change direction, and that accounts for waiting 2 days here, 3 days there, and so forth in order to connect with the wind that takes you in the direction that you want to go. Now, one of the things that we want to note is the distance of these places. Touching at Syracuse, we tarried there 3 days. I understand this was the capital of Sicily. We made a circuit, arrived at Regine, and after one day, a south wind sprang up, and on the second day, we came to Patola, about 180 miles that they sailed on that day, where we found brethren. Now, that's interesting to me. Where we found brethren. Let me see if I can get this map up. Yes.
Geographically, one thing that's interesting, and I know 2 or 3 years ago we saw that exhibit at Pompeii.
Yes.
This is, the Patola is just on the opposite side of the bay from that.
Isn't that interesting? Yes. Yes. You're talking about over here?
Uh-huh.
Yes. That is interesting. A thing that we want to note just here is that they found brethren. Now, we don't know who preached the gospel first in Rome. The Bible doesn't tell us that. And I want to call this to your attention. These are things that you already know, but it's timely to take note of it here. If you'll turn back in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 2, on that first Pentecost following the resurrection of Christ, you'll note that it was the responsibility of Jews to attend these feasts. And we've got Jews that have come from all over the known world to attend these feast days, the observance of the day of Pentecost, and previously the observance of the Passover that was 50 days before. It was quite common for Jews to come from faraway places and plan to be there on the observance of the Passover and to remain there to observe the Jewish feast of Pentecost. And these were, as you know, yearly feasts. But if you'll note, beginning in verse 8, the question is, how hear we every man in our own language wherein we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites and dwellers in Mesopotamia, in Judea, Cappadocia and Pontus and Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, Libya, around Cyrene, and sojourners from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabians. We hear them speaking in our tongues the mighty works of God. That sets the stage for the audience that the apostles are going to address and the need for the apostles to speak these other languages that they had not studied, they had not learned. This too was in the realm of the miraculous. But what we do want to note is the mention of some being there from Rome. Jews have come to Jerusalem from Rome. Now, they hear the apostles preach on this first Pentecost following the resurrection of Christ. One of the things that we've already noted as we were studying in this portion of the text is that over a period of time, they continued to sit at the apostles' feet and they continued to learn. And some of them became needy. The resources that they brought with them ran out, and the brethren in Jerusalem that had houses and lands, they sold that and laid it at the apostles' feet. And I think the implication is they did it more than once to see to it that their brethren, new brethren now from all over the world, that their needs have been taken care of. Now, the time eventually came in Acts chapter 8 that as a result of the persecution many of these people are forced to go home. In Acts chapter 8, there beginning in verse 4, they therefore that were scattered abroad went about preaching the word. You think some of these folks from Rome went back? Some of these folks from Cappadocia went home. And so this is what you have. You think they took the gospel with them? In all probability, yes, they took the gospel with them. It's not just a matter of what they've learned. It's a matter of substance and how they learned it. Here are men who are Galileans and they're speaking other languages. And here are men that are sick and men that are lame and miracles are being performed. So the credentials of the apostles are present. And we've seen that authenticating the word that they're preaching. And so the message of who Jesus is, the message of salvation, is being carried back to the places where these people have traveled from. Now, who took it to Rome? As far as by name, I don't know. I just don't know. But one of the things that you do know is that the book of Acts primarily deals with the Apostle Peter up until Acts chapter 12. And when you read up until Acts chapter 12, beyond Acts chapter 12, now who becomes the major character in the book of Acts? The Apostle Paul. How many apostles were there?
13.
Pardon me?
13
altogether. Now, when you get to counting on that, you see that the other apostles are not particularly mentioned in the book of Acts as far as where they went, the work that they did. And I think this is an interesting observation. Virgil, we were talking about this just recently from Colossians chapter 1, verse 23. I've talked with brethren on this point that frankly, I disagree with. They say, well, in first chapter of Colossians and verse 23, Paul said that the gospel had been preached to every creature under heaven, whereof I, Paul, was made a minister. And they come to the conclusion, well, that was just around the Mediterranean Sea. That was just the known world. You do what you want to do with that. All I know is what it says. That the gospel was preached to every creature under heaven, whereof I, Paul, was made a minister. And where was it that Jesus told the apostles to go preach? Into all the world. Now in chapter 1 of Colossians, verse 23, Paul's saying, whatever the Lord said do, we've done it. It's been done. Now they did that without computers. They did that without telephones, without social media. They did that without television. They did what the Lord told them to do. That includes Rome. I don't know who went to Rome, but we do know that Jews came from Rome and were at Jerusalem when all this began to spread. So the gospel has been preached in Rome, and Paul is not unknown to the saints in Rome. And by the way, just a little note here for your consideration. We often look at the first few verses of the book of Romans and we say, well, the book of Romans is written to the church, and we use that term in the local sense that the epistle to the Romans is written to the church in Rome. Well, we can read in 1 Corinthians, for example, chapter 1, verse 2, that epistle is written to the church of God, which is in Corinth, local church, is it not? We read about the church in Ephesus, local church, is it not? But what you know about Rome is it is a huge city. And the text tells us that it's written to the saints in Rome. Those who are called to be saints. Verse 7. I don't know how many local churches, one or more, may have existed in Rome. But the point being, a very simple one, is that Paul addressed that epistle to the saints in Rome. And because that epistle was to be read by the saints in Rome, written by the Apostle Paul, though Paul has never been to Rome, we know that he is known in Rome. Perhaps not by face, but they know who he is. And the relevance of that is seen in this passage that we're studying in Acts chapter 28, where it tells us that when they came to Puteoli, that they found brethren there. Now, I want you to note that in the rest of that verse, it says, verse 14 now, chapter 28, found brethren and were entreated to tarry with them 7 days, and so we came to Rome. They stayed in Puteoli for 7 days. Why do you suppose they stayed there 7 days? What did they have an idea the church in Puteoli was going to be doing in 7 days? One of those days would be the first day of the week. They'd be able to meet together and worship these brethren. And I think that speaks volumes about this centurion that's in charge of Paul as a prisoner and those who were in his company. But now he has the opportunity to associate with these brethren and to be able to worship with them. And you will note in verse 15, "And from thence the brethren, when they heard of us, came to meet us as far as the market of Appius and the three taverns, whom when Paul saw, he thanked God and took courage." Now, the market, well, we're looking here. They're very, very close. So what we want to note is they're very close to Rome. What do we find when he's getting closer and closer to Rome?
More people.
More people. And more brethren. More brethren are coming to be with him to finish out this leg of the journey. One of the things that I think is noteworthy in our study of the book of Acts is that when we read of brethren sending someone on their way, there was a custom of hospitality that it seemed to have existed during first century times that I sometimes wish existed to a greater degree in present day times. When folks sent someone on their way, they didn't stand on the front porch and say, "Bye, have a good trip." What did they do? They went part way with them. Yeah, they did. They went part way with them. And when somebody's coming, what did they do? They go out and meet them. Yeah, go out and meet them. And sometimes we don't hardly answer the door when somebody comes to the door, much less expecting somebody to come, and we go out and greet them and bring them in. You see the hospitality that existed during first century time. We need to be impressed with that. And that's what they were doing when Paul is on his way to be with them. Now, we might think of these places, the market of Appius and the three taverns, being just right next door to Rome. Well, we're talking about a place that might be anywhere in the neighborhood of 10 miles away, or maybe even 40 miles travel. And they didn't have the means to get an air-conditioned automobile or well-heated automobile, of course, early spring, and travel down there and meet up with these people and give them a nice, comfortable ride home. Their means of travel was not like ours. Can you imagine, without an automobile, traveling 10, 20, 30, 40 miles to meet somebody that's coming to your house? Be impressed with that. That's what the brethren did. And they'd never met this man, but they knew who he was, and he's coming.
How long had they had the Roman letter before he came?
Good question. Paul wrote it from Corinth on his way to Jerusalem, so I would suspect, yeah, in the neighborhood of three years. The first Roman imprisonment lasted about 2 years. We've got some time. I don't know exactly how much time in Jerusalem. We've got about 2 years in Caesarea where he was imprisoned. And we've got in the neighborhood are the estimates of a year in traveling to get to Rome. So, yes. And then you've got to factor on the front end of that, the time that it took to get from Corinth, where he had written that epistle, down to Jerusalem, and then the arrest and all of that there. So, yeah, in the neighborhood of at least three. Yes.
I'd like to point out here the statement in verse 15, the end of verse 15, that when the brethren came to him, that Paul thanked God and took courage.
Yes. Yes.
Frequently read in Paul's letters where he asked congregations, asked people to pray for him.
Yes.
And we kind of gloss over that and say, "Oh, okay, well, that's just kind of a formality." And yeah, it's something that Paul probably asked for just to keep his readers involved in what he's doing, or he doesn't really need this. Paul is a super Christian, and he's And the fact of the matter is, no, he did. He needed the prayers to be able to speak boldly when he needed to speak, to say the right things. So what's the point, though, that I'm trying to bring this down to something that's meaningful to us? Not only do we find passages like this that have meaning that we frequently miss, but let's look at those amongst us. Brother so-and-so, well-known preacher, and surely, you know, he's got it in the bag, he's on his way to heaven, and he doesn't need prayers or strengthening or anything like that. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Oh, no.
And if Paul needed the prayers, if Paul could take encouragement, there at the end of Philippians chapter 4, a passage I've pointed out before, Paul, it's a passage we read over that says, I've learned how to be content in any situation. And we read over that, and what we miss the fact is Paul learned this. He did not at one point in time understand or know this, and therefore if we have to learn to do these things, and Paul had to, we should take great comfort from that.
Well, that's right. I backed off of the matter that was at the top of this map so you can see the entirety of the map. What I want you to see is where Paul wrote the epistle to Rome from. We don't have it labeled on this map, but Corinth is down in here. And when you consider the location of Corinth and him writing to Rome, Paul traveled from here to here, was arrested, and eventually, over a period of years, wound up as a prisoner there. When he wrote this epistle, he's on his way to Jerusalem knowing he's going to be arrested, knowing things are not going to go well. What did he say in that epistle? Writing to the Romans. In Romans chapter 1, look at verse 8. He said, first I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is proclaimed throughout the whole world. He's thankful for his brethren, even these in Rome. Never met them. In the 15th chapter of the book of Romans, knowing that he's traveling with this collection that has come from those in Asia, Macedonia, and Achaia, directed to the needy saints here in Jerusalem. He says in verse 25 of Romans 15, but now I say I go to Jerusalem, ministering to the saints, for it has been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints that are at Jerusalem. Yea, it has been their good pleasure, and their debtors they are, for if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, they owe it to them also to minister unto them in carnal things. When therefore I have accomplished this, and have sealed to them this fruit, I will go on by you unto Spain. And I know that when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of blessings of Christ. Now I beseech you, brethren, look at that. I beseech you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea, and that my ministration which I have for Jerusalem may be acceptable unto the saints, that I may come unto you in joy through the will of God, and together with you find rest. Now the God of peace be with you all. Amen. Three things. I want you to pray for me. I beseech you. What's that word mean? I'm begging, pleading with you. You pray for me. Three things. Number one, that I may be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea. Who are those who are disobedient in Judea? That's right, the unbelieving Jews. You remember when Claudius Lysias first arrested Paul? Why did he arrest him? They were trying to kill him. The arrest of Paul was an answer to the prayers of these people. And then when Claudius Lysias, according to Roman protocol, delivered Paul to the Jewish court, and the Jewish court was divided, what did they try to do to him? Who rescued him? Claudius Lysias. prayer number two, or answered number two a second time. And you remember when there was a plot laid after he had been arrested in Jerusalem, that we bring him now over here to the temple and we'll try him there. And there was a plot laid to kill him on the way. Who found out about it? Claudius Lysias, his nephew, told Claudius Lysias. And what Claudius Lysias do? Moved him over to Caesarea. Time number three. Has the prayers of the Romans been answered? He's been delivered from the disobedient in Jerusalem. The next portion of his prayer is that he might come to them. Has he come to them? Did he need their prayers? Yes. Has their prayers been answered? Yes. Multiple times.
Maybe not the way they thought it would have been.
Sometimes that's the case. But God had heard and had answered their prayers as He had requested. We want to make note of that. Be impressed by it.